Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. The election is in just 41 days, and the Poor People's Campaign is working tirelessly to organize poor and low-income people and get them to the polls. There are 140 million poor and low-wage people across this country. That is 43% of the country. They represent the largest swing vote in this year's election. The Poor People's Campaign says for too long, those in power have ignored us. They are working to mobilize at least 15 million poor and low-wage, infrequent voters across the country. In their new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy, the Reverend William Barber and today's guest, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, write, "We have more income and wealth inequality today than just about any other period in U.S. history. There are 40 million more people, white people, than black people who are poor. Until we face the reality of white people and poverty in the U.S., we cannot comprehend what is exceptional about inequality in the richest country in the world." Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is founder of the School for Conversion, an organization that works for communities that unlearn habits of social division, and assistant director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is featured in Bad Faith, a documentary that reveals how Christian nationalists have succeeded in taking over the Republican Party. You can find the show we did about Bad Faith at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Jonathan. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So the election is right around the corner. What is at stake for poor and low-wage people in this upcoming election?
Well, a lot's at stake for poor folks every day. And a lot of the reason that we wrote White Poverty is because the life and death issues that poor people face have not been part of our public and political conversation for far too long in this country. So in this election, as in every election, this is an opportunity for poor people to have a unified voice in public and to demand that people who are running for public office address the issues that matter to them.
We talked a bit about this last time you were on, Jonathan. We hear politicians say the middle class constantly, but we rarely hear the words poor and poverty. When Kamala Harris put out one of her first ads, my mouth almost dropped, I have to say, because she did talk about childhood poverty in that ad. Mm-hmm. And it's just so rare to hear that word. Why is that?
Well, we've been asking this question for a while. And I think we get different answers from different folks. But I think overwhelmingly, there's a hesitancy to address poverty by people in public life because if we acknowledge the extent of the problem we have, then we would have to have serious conversations about really thinking differently about our political economy. So I think there's a hesitancy by representatives of both the Republican and the Democratic Party to talk about the problem at the extent that it actually exists because it demands so much. This is one of the reasons why we've challenged the official poverty measure. This was established by the federal government in the 1960s and is based on a formula that was developed then that that said that the basic expenses of any household are roughly three times the amount that it spends on food. Well, since that time, the cost of food has roughly quadrupled. However, the cost of housing, the cost of education, transportation, and healthcare is some 16-fold what it was at that time. And so the formula doesn't work well anymore. Nevertheless, that's the basis for every official statistic we have on poverty that comes from the government. And all of our policies that are designed to address poverty are based on those numbers. So since we haven't even been naming the problem, we don't have policies that address the extent of the problem, and we don't have politicians that are talking about it in a way that I think acknowledges it for what it really is.
And you rarely hear this fact that there are 140 million poor and low-wage people across the country. That is a massive number, 43% of the country.
That's right. It's a lot of people, and they're not, you know, poor people aren't somewhere else. Poor people are in every community. When you think about poverty as just not being able to meet the basic necessities of life. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to talk about the, you know, pervasive myths that have persisted through American history, although they have morphed and changed in various ways over time, is that we don't see something that is so before us because we are given stories that allow us to explain it away. So we see folks who are struggling and we say, oh, they must be lazy, they must not be working. Well, the vast majority of poor and low-wage people are, in fact, low-wage people. They are working sometimes two and three jobs and not able to make ends meet. So poverty isn't just the, you know, person who you might see on the corner who isn't able to work and is asking for help. Poverty is the person who maybe bags your groceries at the grocery store but can't afford to feed their own family. Poverty is often people who are doing in-home health care or care work in facilities and yet aren't able to afford health care for themselves. Poverty is people who work in factories and in warehouse facilities and have to sleep in their car at night. So this is an issue that is much broader than what we see, and yet these myths sort of allow us to overlook it. Race, of course, is the most persistent of those myths, and we wanted to write about white poverty because we really do believe that the way that poverty has been racialized, so that when people hear poverty, they think about black people, allows us to pretend or to, you know, carry on with this illusion that poverty isn't the problem that it is.
In the book, you write, if you disaggregate the data on the 140 million Americans who are technically poor or low income, 24 million are black. That is 60% of all black people in the U.S., an incredible burden that reflects the ongoing influence of racism in American life, and one that is shared by a similar percentage of the population in Native and Latino communities. But when you look at the raw numbers of poor and low income people, there are 66 million white people, almost three times the number of black Americans. Most people cannot see that poverty is an epidemic impacting nearly half of Americans. And this is what you never hear. Most of America's poor are white. Can you talk about that and why you and the Reverend Barber decided to write a book called White Poverty?
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to my brother here. Reverend Barber, as most folks probably know, is an African American. He has been a civil rights leader both in the state of North Carolina here and across the country. Nevertheless, from the time I met him as a young person in a rural, predominantly white community in North Carolina, he has been willing to go to places where people who don't look like him are suffering and to insist that the moral demand to speak up for justice and to be on the side of poor and hurting people applies to everyone. So that's literally how we met when I was still a teenager. And our friendship has been a fusion friendship. We talk a lot about fusion politics in the book and in our work together. And that's just the basic recognition that in American history, black and white people have worked together in fusion coalitions, and those fusion coalitions are the movements that have pushed us toward a more perfect union at every phase, whether it was Reconstruction after the Civil War or what we usually call the Civil Rights Movement in the mid-20th century, or the movements today that are fighting for living wages and for addressing the climate crisis and such. These are fusion movements that bring people together who have been pitted against one another. And we thought it was critical to write about white poverty as a way into the need for a fusion movement today, because this issue of of racializing poverty has split what is the largest potential swing vote in the country. That is poor people who often don't participate at the same rate as their wealthier neighbors because they don't see that voting would make a huge difference for them. And yet, if they did, the numbers are such that poor people could swing every election statewide in the country. So speaking to this demographic is incredibly important for any politician who wants to, you know, increase their margins. But we think this demographic recognizing their own power and demanding that politicians speak to their issues is critical to developing both the measures that genuinely identify poverty for what it is and the policies that can address it.
Can you talk about the work that the Poor People's Campaign is doing out in the country? There are a couple of tweets about the National Canvassing Weekend to mobilize poor and low-income voters from Wisconsin to Massachusetts to North Carolina and Rhode Island. State coordinating committee members are meeting with poor and low-income voters. So tell us what is happening on the ground.
Well, this is a beautiful thing. So people who have joined this movement over the last 6 years, we relaunched the Poor People's Campaign in 2018, people have formed coordinating committees in their states. These committees are led by people who are directly impacted by poverty and allies who care about this because they see the connection of poor people's issues to issues that impact them. And these coordinating committees have been organizing folks to reach out to their neighbors in low-income communities. And this is the kind of canvassing that never happens in campaign seasons because the parties and the PACs always send people to talk to likely voters. And they consider poor people to be unlikely voters because, as I said earlier, poor people don't vote at the same rates as their wealthier neighbors. And yet, what we've found is that poor people say over and over again, we don't show up, not because we don't care, but because we don't hear anyone speaking to us. And so this campaign has been building power around issues that matter to poor people and to low-income communities. And so we're doing peer-to-peer canvassing, people going to their neighbors to talk about not a particular candidate, but to talk about why these issues matter, why the agenda of this campaign matters, and why people can take the policy proposals and ideas that are coming out of this campaign. They can hold the options that are before them alongside one another, and they can show up and vote for the best available option right now, and then use their power to push for more after this election. So that's what's happening in communities, and there's canvassing going on door to door. There's phone banking and texting going on to really give poor and low-income people resources to reach out to their own networks, their own communities, and talk about why they do have the power to make a difference in this election.
What strikes you about what you're hearing out on the streets? So many people are suffering in this country, and like we said, we hardly hear the word poverty in the news coverage. As you all say on your website, you've got so many facts. Nearly one-third of the U.S. labor force earns less than $15 an hour. So what are you hearing? What strikes you?
Well, that issue of poverty wages, I think, is the number one thing I hear from people. These are people who are working every day and who are just trying to figure out how to make ends meet. And I was talking to an organizer with the campaign in West Virginia, and she was expressing her genuine frustration. She said, "I've been working for low wages my whole life." And she said, "It always feels like election time comes around and the politicians are talking at us, they're not talking to us." And I think that's a lot of what we hear, that people want their reality to be acknowledged. And I think we're hearing, in this campaign season, a lot about inflationary pressure, a lot about grocery prices, and a lot about the cost of housing. These are important things. But I think wages are a huge issue, and they so often just don't come up in the debate. I mean, we had a one presidential debate for 90 minutes, and while the economy was a topic, we didn't talk about the fact, that there are millions of people in this country who are working full time and not earning enough to survive. That's a major issue that impacts people every day, and that I think creates a real vulnerability in our politics, a real space where people can be manipulated because they don't feel like the system is working for them.
You quote someone on one of your fact sheets, Stephanie, a Starbucks worker with United in New York. She says, like most of my coworkers, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. Many of us have second jobs, and it's still barely enough to get by. Meanwhile, the CEO of Starbucks just got a $60 million golden parachute. It's our labor that has made Starbucks a multi-billion dollar corporation, and all we are asking for is what we deserve. Jonathan, can you spend a little more time talking about wages? Because the federal minimum wage has not moved in so many years. And the fact of the matter is, $15, remember the fight for 15? Well, that's just no longer enough for so many people across this country to pay their rent and to make ends meet. So to think that nearly one third of the U.S. labor force earns less than $15 an hour, but even 15 for so many people is not enough. So what is the status of raising the federal minimum wage at this time and the Fight for 15 campaign?
Well, I'll give you a status update, but let me go back in time a little bit and just emphasize that this key demand has been central to the movement for economic justice, which is connected to the movement for racial justice throughout U.S. history. So if you rewind to the March on Washington in 1963, that march called itself a march for jobs and justice. And the first agenda item on that march's list of demands was a $2 an hour minimum wage. If you index that for inflation since then, and they had been able to achieve it, the minimum wage in the U.S. today would be $17 and some odd cents. So we've had a movement in this country for many decades now that has been led by poor and working people who say that we are forced to work in an economy where the wage floor is so low that there is always a portion of our society that is struggling to survive. And the Fight for 15 emerged out of that reality because of the fact that the gap in the value of real wages actually had widened at the end of the 20th and early 21st century. And so we had inequality at levels that we had not seen since the Gilded Age, just before the Great Depression. And people who were doing low-wage work that was often service work, even as we had seen so much of the manufacturing jobs and union jobs that had sustained the middle class and through much of the 20th century, we saw those going away after NAFTA and such. Those service workers began to organize, and critical to the rise of the Fight for 15 was that union leadership recognized that they needed to support this new workers' movement. Got to give credit to Mary Kay Henry, who was leading the SEIU at that time, and who offered the support of the union to this emerging service workers' movement. And they began to make a demand for a Fight for 15 in 2012. Well, like you say, I mean, the real value of even $15 an hour isn't enough to survive in many places in the United States anymore. But that campaign has continued and has actually grown and developed into what is today the Fight for a Union. And the Fight for a Union is a fight to end poverty wages and to unionize as many service workers as possible. And SEIU and other unions have set ambitious goals to organize service workers over the next decade. The campaign has also been, you know, central to the work that we've been doing with the Poor People's Campaign. They've been, all those unions have been key partners with us. And we have had real success in putting this on the agenda, at least of the Democratic Party, since 2016. Unfortunately, because of the messaging things we were talking about earlier, this doesn't often get touted even by party leaders. But in the current platform of the Democratic Party, there is a commitment to raising the minimum wage and to ending the sub-minimum wage, which is another piece of this. 16 million restaurant workers can still be paid $2.13 an hour if they are tip workers. And so this is a movement that has pushed a party to at least embrace this as goals. And yet I think the movement continues to push to make it a real priority. In this current administration, we had one bill that passed the House and went to the Senate and was killed by the filibuster there. Both Republicans and some Democrats refused to pass the bill that would have raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. So we are still, as you said, at $7.25 federally, and that has been the same since 2009. Mm. I think this is a huge issue for low-income voters, and something that that they're insisting that you know, as they speak to their representatives, if we elect you, if you have majorities in the Congress, this is a high priority, I think among the highest priorities in terms of actually addressing the crisis of poverty in this country.
And last year, Democrats were pushing for a $17 minimum wage, but it wouldn't completely go into effect until the year 2028.
Yeah, this is what often happens with the legislation. There's a campaign from businesses that say, well, you know, this would be a shock to our bottom line and would have to impact our pricing, and so we need to gradually roll it in. And so many of the pieces of legislation that actually get proposed to raise the minimum wage do it incrementally over time. The movement the Fight for 15 has insisted that we need at least 15 now. And this movement has also, I think wisely, said that this new minimum wage has to be indexed with inflation. It's too much of a political struggle to have to come back and build, you know, the movement that's required to get the political will in Congress to raise the wage, you know, every time it needs to be raised. We need a wage floor that is livable and that is indexed with inflation, so that as time moves on, people will continue to work for a wage that gives them the basics they need to survive.
And it's important to note that California has a $20 an hour minimum wage law for fast food jobs. And according to the state, California has actually added 11,000 new fast food jobs. As of July, California has, wow, this is incredible, 750,500 fast food jobs, the most in state history. And there's a $20 an hour minimum wage law that is in effect for fast food jobs. So it's just really important data, because while we were talking, Jonathan, I was doing some research on this Democrat bill that would raise the minimum wage to $17. And mm-hmm. The Republicans put out this press release saying that it's going to cost jobs. Like you said, they always say that. But here in the state of California, according to data, that has not happened.
Yeah, that's good data to have, and it's reflective of the real consensus of economists. The Nobel Prize a few years ago was actually given to a couple of economists from Princeton who studied this years ago when there was a raise in the minimum wage on one side of the border of the New Jersey-Pennsylvania divide close to them there. They raised the wage on one side and not on the other. So they took that opportunity to get lots of survey data from fast food workers on both sides, and what they demonstrated in their work at that time was that that this myth that raising the wage will cost jobs really is a myth. It doesn't happen. California has been another example of that. People continue to eat, and so restaurants continue to hire people to prepare and serve food for people to eat. This is the reality that most economists have observed when they've actually looked into this. Nevertheless, the myth persists, and the myth is why even some Democrats did not support that bill that came from the House over in 2021 as part of the initial large package to address the COVID crisis.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. He wrote the book White Poverty with the Poor People's Campaign, Reverend William Barber. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is founder of the School for Conversion, an organization that works for communities that unlearn habits of social division, and assistant director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Jason Stanley about his new book, Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Thursday, Peter Goodman will discuss his book, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. He has so much great information in here about what is really happening with the economy. We hope you can join us tomorrow and the next day. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are joined by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, co-author of White Poverty: How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Jonathan is founder of the School for Conversion, an organization that works for communities that unlearn habits of social division. He'll talk about that work later in the show. He's also assistant director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments or a personal story to share, 140 million poor and low-wage people live in this country. That is 43% of the country. They represent the largest swing vote in this year's election. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Kim in San Francisco. Hi, Kim. Thanks for waiting patiently. Welcome to the show.
Hey. Hi, Rose. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, good. You know, it's wonderful. I am so glad about this show. As a matter of fact, I've got the book. I went and got it last night, so I haven't really gotten to it. The thing that I want to say to Mr. Hartgrove is when he mentions the 60s, and when we think about Martin Luther King doing that Poor People's March, the original Poor People's March, you know, he said three things, you know, could really go down with this country, that could really take this country down. And I think it was militarism, classism, and I think it was poverty. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like the chickens have really come back home to roost, you know, with this thing that's happening now with these guys, which I believe, you know, contributed to his death, so to speak, because he knew that relationship and that connection, see, to the vote and what's going on today. And we hear this guy Trump, you know, with the constant, you know, sort of like the red coats are coming, the immigrants are coming, and we need to be afraid of these guys, you know, when in actuality, we shouldn't fear these guys at all. You know, we need to really get together. We need to do something about the situation that's affecting us all. And when you look at 43% of the population, that's the population that King had. and was ready to have, if not more, over 60 years ago with this situation to that of which we are suffering today. So the other thing I want to ask Mr. Hargrove is, how does he see the situation today in terms of, you know, this whole thing, you know, with the immigrants and people coming here? Because mm-hmm. when you think in terms of immigrants, 25% of immigrants are the small business makers of this country. So I want to hear Mr. Hargrove's thoughts, you know, on what he thinks.
Oh, thank you,
about.
Kim. I sure do appreciate you reminding us of Dr. King and the what he called the triplets of evil. You're right. It's racism, it's militarism, and it was poverty. And that was what he laid out in that speech 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. He gave that speech at Riverside Church in New York City. I think it's critically important to understanding his vision. And in terms of the diagnosis that vision offers, I think you're absolutely right. He recognized that level of poverty creates a political vulnerability that makes possible the kind of fascist leader who will come and say to people, you know, who've been suffering, I can explain your suffering. It's those people who are causing you to suffer. It's those people who are causing you to suffer. That has happened over and over again in this country's history. And to your second question, I would say we're watching it right in front of us. The scapegoating of immigrants, the politics that says, elect me because I will make your life better by getting rid of those people. I mean, that kind of politics is just deeply rooted in the myths that we are writing about here in white poverty. And it's so, so dangerous. The Repairers of the Breach, which is the organization that Reverend Barber is president and founder of, and that I work with him through that organization. We do the Poor People's Campaign as well as other initiatives around the country. We were in Springfield this past weekend supporting local faith leaders there who came together for representing different faiths to say that our faiths agree on this, that not only are we called to welcome the stranger, but our faith traditions have many, many stories that tell us that God is present to us in the stranger, in the immigrant, in the person who comes from elsewhere. Part of the welcome is this recognition that what we need in order to be all that it's possible for us to be as human beings is in part in our partnership with people who come to us from elsewhere. And that's why in my tradition, Jesus says, when I was a stranger, you welcomed me. On the economic level, as you were suggesting, and as people in Springfield were saying, the economic renewal of that community over the past decade has been dependent on immigrants in so many places, and not just urban places. In many small towns and rural communities across the country, we have a mix of people who, you know, have been there for a few generations and people who've come quite recently, building community together. That is possible, and it makes a kind of community possible in places that is necessary for democracy to survive. But this ongoing myth that tries to blame other people for the suffering that folks are experiencing, largely because extremely wealthy forces are exploiting them, that has to be addressed. And so that is a piece of what the Poor People's Campaign and other moral fusion movements are doing by bringing together the folks who might be pitted against one another by racist narratives, by these anti-immigrant narratives, bringing folks together and saying, we have a common cause. We are going to work together for economic justice, for an economy that works for everyone.
Jonathan, you all write about this in the book. What myth makes it possible for a white person in Mitchell County to believe that they have more in common with politicians who refuse to expand Medicaid than they do with Black folks in another part of the state who face many of the same challenges they do. So you've got Trump and J.D. Vance just doubling down on racist comments about Haitians and so many other people, doubling down on saying horrific things about women. We can just talk about this for hours. I also think about Stephanie Grisham, who was Trump's former press secretary, and, and she said that when the cameras were off, Trump mocked his supporters. He called them basement dwellers. On a hospital visit, when people were dying in the ICU, he was mad that the cameras were not watching him. So how do you explain, I mean, forget the billionaires, like the Uline family and all these people who are supporting them. We know that they want tax cuts and no regulation, and really, they don't really believe in democracy. That's what Abigail Disney says about her relatives' very, very wealthy friends. But what about poor and low-income people? Why are millions of them still voting for Trump?
Well, a couple of things here. One is that I think we have to look closely at the support and recognize that most poor people don't support this. So, you know, Trump has ran for president twice, both against Clinton and Biden, and actually a slightly larger margin with Biden. He lost the under 50,000 income earner vote when, you know, exit polls break people, break voters down by their income. So it's not the case that the majority of poor people are being hoodwinked. Nevertheless, it is true that, as you said, millions of people are supporting this kind of politics. And we've had lots of people scratching their heads and asking why, lots of sociologists, you know, doing stories and writing books on this. I think the single biggest factor is to look at where those billionaires who have benefited from this kind of division have been putting their money for the last 40 years. And that's part of why I've been spending a good bit of time with the film you mentioned earlier called Bad Faith, looking at, you know, it's a kind of community education tool to help people understand what the Council for National Policy has been doing in terms of isolating communities and encircling them with messaging that repeats these narratives over and over again. And so something that, you know, if you're living in the Bay Area and you see it on TV and it just sounds absolutely ridiculous, it doesn't sound as ridiculous to people when it's mediated through local media that has been geared to, you know, to pitch it favorably to them, through these nonprofit organizations that have reached out to them and have offered them a narrative in which this makes sense. I just think it's important for people to realize that as mean as someone like Trump looks when you're observing him from your location, there are people who live in a world where he has been painted as this kind of grandfatherly figure who is, you know, trying to help folks like them. And that is a distortion. It's a lie, and it is an extremely well-funded lie. And I think we have to acknowledge that a piece of that reality in so many places, and these are many of them largely rural and overwhelmingly white and Christian places, is that that movement has worked through religious communities to give this narrative the sanction of the religious cultists in those places. And that combination of, you know, the news you hear when you're out on the tractor and the magazines that come for free to your house and the local pastor repeating it, that creates what the journalist Ann Nelson has called a wraparound culture that has made it incredibly difficult for people in some parts of the country to hear another story.
Right, and the media also has a lot to do with it. We're very lucky in the Bay Area where we've got three public radio stations. We have a thriving media in San Francisco, but in many parts of the country, that's really not the case. That they've got right-wing radio, they have religious conservative radio, and then they've got their local news, local TV, and sometimes they get the same news from Oh, I don't remember the name of it, but we've seen those videos.
Sinclair.
Thank you, Sinclair.
Where they're repeating local news stations, yeah.
Right, where they're repeating the same thing. You know, in our remaining minutes, given that that's the reality, there's so much really incredible work, though, going on among, even in the religious community, that we might not hear much about in the Bay Area. Can you tell us more about that, about how the religious community is really organizing around poverty, raising wages, talking about dignity, the right to unionize?
Oh yes, absolutely. This is the good news. I mean, the bad news is amplified by, you know, multi-billion dollar businesses, but the reality is that on the ground, people who are in many cases informed by their faith traditions, in some cases informed by just their, you know, basic desire to build a community that works for everybody with their neighbors, people are doing all kinds of things. And at the end of the day, I continue to believe that democracy is possible, a multi-ethnic democracy is possible in this country, because I have seen so many people who have so few resources giving so much of themselves to this work. One piece of it I would highlight is the labor organizing that I mentioned earlier, just the many ways that people are coming together and saying we have power as workers to demand something better. I live here in Durham, North Carolina. The Union of Southern Service Workers is one outgrowth of that Fight for 15, Fight for a Union that's been happening for some time. But you know, it's focused on just the reality of the Southern economy and the way that it has depended for so long on what are essentially slave wages, and this recognition that even, you know, in right-to-work states, even without a union, people can organize and make demands of local employers and use the power they have to make things better. And in the process, you know, are creating a kind of local democratic culture that's cross race lines, that, you know, is interreligious, but that takes morality seriously. I mean, that's one of the things I've loved about that movement from the very beginning. They've always said, you know, this isn't just a struggle of our interests versus the boss's interests. This is a basic moral issue that impacts everybody. And so, you know, at their rallies, at their walkouts, at their actions where they make demands of employers, they've invited local clergy and pastors and moms, rabbis and others to join them and to be there, you know, and to say this is a moral issue. So I think there's that kind of work. There's also people who are doing, I think, important work to cross these lines and to sort of publicly demonstrate that it's possible to have mutually beneficial relationships, for example, like what we were talking about earlier with immigrants who are being demonized. I mean, you know, communities that have come together, declared themselves places of sanctuary, have said, you know, they want to. I've been in touch with lots of churches that they want to be, you know, one congregation, but worship in different languages and have, you know, multiple services so that people can worship in that space. I mean, those kinds of cooperative projects on the ground, I think, demonstrate that democracy continues to be possible, even despite all these divisions that are so exploited by this radical, well-funded movement we were talking about earlier.
Hmm. Can you give us a sense of what's going on in North Carolina? We won't spend much time about what is happening with Mark Robinson. I'm sure that is getting, I mean, it's getting so much attention across the country, but probably so much more attention where you are in North Carolina. What is happening in North Carolina on the ground? The organizing that's happening there? What are the conversations you're hearing about the election?
Well, I think people in North Carolina realize that so much is at stake and that we've already lost so much to extremism. I mean, you know, Mark Robinson is not just running for governor. He is the lieutenant governor of the state and has used that position not largely to even fulfill the basic duties of the office, but rather to just create more of this kind of animosity in communities. And so, yeah, in response, what has happened is, a lot of, and this is beyond the parties, a lot of groups have formed that are doing this kind of neighborhood and community-based base building. A lot of what folks call deep canvassing. Have you heard of deep canvassing? People going door to door and talking to neighbors about why things aren't working, and then drawing the connections about how, you know, the extremists who took over our state house, you know, before people like Mark Robinson came to the fore, this movement was to take over state government. And when they took it over, they did things like cut public education funding. Mm. They did things like, deny people the extension of a federally funded unemployment insurance program. They denied people Medicaid expansion here for a decade. We just this year finally won Medicaid expansion, and hundreds of thousands of people who didn't have access to health care finally were able to have it 10 years after it was available.
Wow.
So people have seen that political extremism has real impact on communities, you know, rural hospitals closing, low wages, just basic challenges that people face, but that this grassroots organizing and building power can make a difference. And so I see that happening all over the state.
Well, and it's also home to Moral Mondays, incredible organizing. Well, Jonathan, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we would love to have you back to continue this important conversation about what it takes to organize poor and low-income people and the really incredible work they're doing across the country. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is co-author of the book White Poverty: How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Thank you so much for your work, Jonathan, and thanks for joining us again.
Oh, a joy to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.